So welcome. This is the first meeting this session of the General Government Accountability Committee, and it is for February 1st, and I'm going to open that session. The first order of business is to adopt the rules, so I'm going to open a work session on adopting the rules. Shine, would you give us anything that stands out in those rules?
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the rules, as most of the members are aware, are substantially similar from long session to long session, and that's the case this time as well. They are identical from committee to committee, and they're based on the chamber rules. We're having a discussion, and we couldn't recall if this particular rule was new, so we thought we'd recite it to make sure we touched on it in case it was unfamiliar to anyone. Proposed amendments. This is Rule 15 of the proposed committee rules. Proposed amendments by other than members of the Legislative Assembly must be submitted in writing to the committee staff at least 24 hours prior to the work session at which they are to be considered. And then the posting requirement of at least 1 hour in advance is the same for all amendments as it was last time.
Thank you. Senator DeVore.
Chair Riley, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated today, February 1st, 2017.
Vice Chair DeVore moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated today. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes. Rules are adopted. Next, we're going to have just some introductory remarks. I want to have the committee members introduce themselves briefly. Where you're from, what things you're planning to do in this committee. So. Kim, let's start with you.
How far back do you want me to go? 1960. Okay. I am from Senate District 13, and that covers a very narrow swath of land. It starts up in Hillsboro and goes down to Kaiser and includes Wilsonville and Sherwood and Newburgh. I got to get my pat better. Newburgh, St. Paul, and Kaiser. So that is where I am from. And I am thankful that the chair was willing to go in with me and petition the good Senate president to get this committee going, and I'm glad I'm on it.
Hi, I'm Floyd Brzezonski, State Senator now, District 4. District 4 includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. Geographic landmass, it's the largest district west of the Cascades. A lot of land, a lot of trees. But the same number of people. This is starting my 14th year in the legislature, in the Senate, I should say. Had the opportunity to do seven prior to that in the House. This is my first time to be on the Senate General Government Committee. I had the opportunity to do that in 2003 on the House side for one session. So I really look forward to being part of the team here. I understand we're going to be picking up some hefty stuff, such as open meetings, public records, and a few other things that we want to unify across the state for we can make certain everyone's on the same page and you don't have different interpretations from county to county. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to be part of the committee.
Thank you, Senator DeVore.
Alan DeBoer from District 3. I'm here through the unfortunate circumstance of Senator Bates passing away and fulfilling the last 2 years of his term. My district is the cities of Ashland, Talent, Phoenix, Jacksonville, and almost all of Medford, so southern Oregon, where I was born and raised and lived my whole life. So I'm looking forward to learning. I'm officially the most junior senator in the Senate, so due to the losing of a coin flip. And so anyway, look forward to the learning experience and challenges we face ahead.
Thank you. Senator Haas, we're just doing introductions.
Yes, Mark Haas from Beaverton in Washington County. Looking forward to working on this new committee.
Great. And I'm Chuck Riley. I'm the senator from Hillsboro, Corneas, Forest Grove, North Plains, Roy, Verbort, and a bunch of farms. And this is the first time I've chaired this committee. As Senator Thatcher pointed out, we had to go and petition the Senate president to actually create this committee. So we're hoping we can live up to that. So with that, I think we wanted to open an informational meeting on agency rulemaking. Cheyenne, what do we have going here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Wolf, Chief Counsel of the General Counsel Division with Oregon Department of Justice is here with a colleague, and they'll be introducing themselves, as well as Melissa Sidlick, the Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel with the Office of Legislative Counsel here in the building. That'll dovetail and follow.
Welcome.
Chair Riley, Vice Chair DeBoer, members of the committee, good afternoon. Thank you. My name's Steve Wolf. I'm Chief Counsel of the General Counsel Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. My colleague, Amy Alpaw, is our opinions counsel. We're here at your invitation to provide a brisk overview, I think, of APA rulemaking processes. I did want to mention I'm a proud Kaiserite, so I appreciate Senator Thatcher's representation here. Administrative Procedures Act has two main parts, contested cases and agency rulemaking. And here to talk about that second part, the Attorney General has a role to play in the administration of the APA through the development of uniform and model rules for both the rulemaking and for the contested case hearings. The Attorney General also publishes on a regular basis the Administrative Procedures Manual, which covers both of those. And so today, about half of this manual is on rulemaking. We're obviously not going to cover all of that. You talk about the view from 30,000 feet, and I think what going to probably provide here is the view from low Earth orbit, you know, traveling at a very high rate of speed, covering a lot of ground. But happy, this is your time, so happy to answer any questions if there's something that you think needs further elucidation. Excuse me, we prepared some written materials, which I think have been provided to the committee, and so the presentation is basically going to follow the organization of those written materials. Ms. Alpaw is here to assist with questions and to correct me when I make an error, which is likely to happen, but hopefully not too many and not too profound. Talking about just the basic principles and overview of the rulemaking process. Rulemaking is one of the two main mechanisms agencies have to exercise their authority to pursue the missions that they're given by legislation or by the Constitution, the other one being orders in individual cases. But rules are the way that they develop standards that apply generally in their regulatory responsibilities. There are a few principles that underlie that. One is, a very important one, is that the agency can only adopt rules pursuant to statutory or constitutional authority. The rulemaking authority extends only so far as their organic authority extends. And consequently, they have to have independent legal authority to adopt rules or to issue orders. In making rules, they have various constraints. Among them is they have to provide notice to the public. They have to invite and receive and consider any input from the public that is offered. Also, very importantly, they have to assess the potential fiscal impact of rules that they adopt. And there are various components of that. One is just the general fiscal impact. We'll talk about some of this in a little bit more detail as we go along. But among the things, the general impact, the impact on businesses generally, and specifically the impact on small businesses are areas that agencies have to consider and have to include in their rulemaking process as information to the public. most of this applies. There are two kinds of rulemaking. One is the permanent rulemaking to which all of these requirements apply. So if an agency is adopting a rule that's going to have permanent impact, they have to go through all of these processes. Agencies can, in some circumstances, adopt temporary rules without going through all of those process requirements. They have to have a justification for doing so, and those rules are only good for 180 days, at which point they expire. Also, we'll talk a little bit about the review of rules. There are several avenues for reviewing rules after they're adopted. The main thing about rulemaking is that most agencies must conform to, use the procedures provided for in the Administrative Procedure Act to adopt rules. Some agencies may be exempt from all or part of the Act, very few agencies. Some agencies may have their own special statutory authority to and processes to adopt rules. But by and large, agencies are subject to the Administrative Procedures Act. The Attorney General, as I mentioned, adopts model rules to implement those the requirements of the Administrative Act, Procedures Act, and agencies can adopt those rules in whole or in part. We tend to recommend that they adopt them in whole, but agencies do have some latitude as long as the rules, the process rules that they adopt, conform to the requirements, the statutory requirements of the APA. The process of developing rules goes through various stages and takes a period of time. And the first thing that the agency will do is develop the rule. They perceive a need for it, and they have to develop it. Now, a lot of agencies, they can do that just on their own internally. We often recommend that there's a process for using advisory committees to help agencies develop rules. And we tend to recommend that agencies use that process to get input from people who are likely to be affected by the rule or people who have an interest in the subject matter of the rule, might be able to provide expertise. There's another process where if you have a lot of stakeholders who have differing views, a collaborative rulemaking process that's used to help try to develop a consensus on what the rule should look like. I think this is fairly rarely used, but it is a process that's provided for in the APA. The basic component of the basic process for adopting rules is that Oregon is a notice and comment state. They have to notice the rules, provide notice to people who are likely to be interested, and we'll talk about a little bit about that notice, and they have to provide the opportunity for a comment, either written comment or comment through public hearings. The APA, we do emphasize, just sets minimum standards for those processes. Agencies can establish processes that provide for greater public input, greater collaboration, greater collection of information, greater notice than the APA requires. But the APA sets the floor. When they go about noticing or providing notice of the rule, the notice has to contain a lot of information. And in the written materials on pages 2 or 3, there's a list of the various things that the notice has to include. A brief caption, 15 words, no more than 15 words, that explains briefly what the rule is going to do, a little more extensive explanation of the rule's purpose and what it intends to accomplish. If there's going to be a hearing, the time and date, how a person can obtain a copy of the proposed rule if it is not included with the notice, the authority underlying the rule, what statutes authorize the agency to adopt the rule, and the rule, any law that the rule is intended to implement. They also have to include a statement of need for the rule. Why are we adopting this rule, and how is this rule going to meet that need? And again, very importantly is the fiscal impact determination. All agencies have to have a fiscal impact statement. The agency also has to use available information to determine whether there's going to be a significant economic impact on business, and specifically has to include the cost of compliance effect on small business. What is it going to cost small businesses, which are defined in the statute as businesses with 50 or fewer employees, what costs are they likely to incur in complying with the rule? The agency also has to specifically invite comment on whether there are less costly alternatives for achieving the same goal that the agency wants to achieve with this rule. Developing the rule, then the providing notice is the next step. Actually, providing notice to the people, and there are again various. Hierarchy of notice that has to be provided. Now, first, the agency has to have a notice rule. Each agency must adopt a notice rule indicating how it's going to provide notice, to whom it's going to provide notice, contents of notice, so that they have then to provide notice first at least 49 days before the effective date of the rule to certain legislators, and those are ordinarily the chairs and co-chairs of committees that have considered the rule, or interim committees that have some responsibility with regard to the agency. At the request, the notice to legislators is important for a couple of reasons, one of which is that any legislator can, or a person affected by the rulemaking, can request that the committees receiving notice review the proposed rule to determine whether it actually conforms to the pertinent legislation that the agency has cited in its proposed rulemaking. So that's 49 days before, at least 28 days before the agency has to give notice to everybody on its mailing list. Anybody, in addition to whomever is in their notice rule, anybody who wants to be informed about an agency's rulemaking can ask to be put on the agency's mailing list, and they will receive notice of all rulemaking that the agency proposes to engage in. And then at least 21 days before the effective date, the agency has to give notice by publication, general publication, in the Secretary of State's bulletin, and there are processes for doing that.
So let me stop you for a second. There are multiple ways, probably, that agencies can give notice. Is that correct?
There are. The default mechanism is paper notice by mail. People can you can request email notice.
And legislators, there is a statute that you guys get it by electronically, but we have, we do postcard, email, paper, and we try to conform to what people want to get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So would you state your name for the record, please?
I'm sorry. My name is Amy Alpaw from DOJ.
Thank you. Okay. So continue. Thank you.
So having provided the notice, then agency invites the public comment or hearing. And again, there are two main mechanisms for doing that. An agency must at least provide a comment period for people to submit written comments on the rules. Agencies can also hold public hearings. It's not mandatory in most cases. Some agencies are required to hold public hearings on their rules or on particular kinds of rules. But as a general matter, it's optional, except that if 10 or more people request a public hearing, or if an association of 10 or more people requests a public hearing, then the agency must hold a public hearing on the rule. And so we tend to recommend to clients that if they think that a rule is going to be at all controversial, to notice a public hearing at the outset to avoid kind of possible delay down the road if they then get a request, have to hold a public hearing, and that kind of backs them up. So providing that that option is critical. The agency then can set a timeline for when comments must be received. There are various mechanisms for extending that timeline. The agency can do it on its own notice. A person who needs additional time to submit a comment can request that the timeline be extended. Now, if the agency does extend the comment period, it must do that for everybody. It can't just do that to accommodate one person who wants to submit comments. If they're extending the comment period, then that means anybody who still wants to comment can come in within the revised comment period and provide those.
Excuse me.
Yes, absolutely.
Chair Riley, one of the things about the public hearing is that sometimes you have more than one public hearing, and if you think it's going to, and the agency can travel to and go where necessary, but if a rule is really just going to be impacting a particular geographic area, you're supposed to go to that area to have your hearing.
Yes. The so both the oral testimony, if there's a public hearing, people can provide the opportunity for oral testimony or to submit written testimony at these hearings, or any other written comments that are provided, have to become a part of the rulemaking record. A couple of other things one other thing I wanted to mention is that if at any time before the rule is intended to become effective, five or more people can request that the agency prepare and submit a statement identifying the objectives of the rule and how the agency will determine whether the rule has accomplished that objective. And so that's mandatory if they receive that request from at least five people. Having done that, I think also wanted to mention with regard to the fiscal impact statement that there's a mechanism for objection to that. If I believe it's 10 yes. or more people object to the fiscal impact statement that the agency has submitted in its rulemaking and think that it's inadequate, then the agency is required to appoint a fiscal impact committee to assess the fiscal impact of the rule. Some agencies are required to have advisory committees. That advisory committee will, as a component of it, have a fiscal impact role. But if an agency is required to have an advisory committee, they cannot appoint employees or agents of the agency to that committee. It has to be people from outside the agency. And so we, again, recommend that agencies, if they're going to put together a committee of that kind, find people with the appropriate expertise, either in making fiscal assessment or in understanding of the area the area that's being regulated, in developing a committee of that kind.
Just want to add one thing. So if you appoint an advisory committee, whether you have to or you want to. And we certainly recommend it. The advisory committee has to give input on the fiscal impact. They must. And if you have an advisory committee or you have a fiscal advisory committee, then if you determine that your initial fiscal impact statement was not accurate, you can go back and amend it. You give extra notice to people and such. But if you didn't have an advisory committee or you didn't have a fiscal impact statement advisory committee, you can't. You would have to go back and start rulemaking all over again. So tried to get that right up front.
Yes, that's exactly correct. So having done all that, having gotten the public comment, then the agency has to create its rulemaking record, and that consists of all of the comments received. And the agency is required to consider fully all the written or oral comments received in arriving at a final version of the rule. The final version of the rule does not have to be the original proposed version of the rule, but it does have to Any changes that are made have to still be within the original statement of need and description of the rule. We recommend that if a final version of the rule, even if it does is going to come at least arguably within the original description, if there are substantive changes from the original rule, it might be wise in some cases for the agency to restart the rulemaking process rather than adopt a rule that hasn't in its final version been provided necessarily the kind of information notice that the public might have liked to have had in when they were commenting on it. There is, I want to correct that there's an incomplete sentence on in the written materials on page 5, which talks about the comment and agency response. There's a sentence fragment that says the agency must respond to comments. That is inaccurate in its incompleteness. The agency ordinarily is not required to respond to comments. They are required to respond to comments on the comments that are submitted on whether there are alternative ways of reducing the impact on small business and the cost of compliance. The agency must respond to those kinds of comments. Having done that, arrived at a final version, then the formal adoption of the rule takes place. Ordinarily, with an agency with an executive head, the executive head has that authority to adopt it. The agency can also delegate the rulemaking responsibility to a named person within the agency. It cannot be just to an office, but they can do a formal delegation to an officer within the agency to do the rulemaking. If it's a border commission, the border commission must adopt the rule in a public vote in a public meeting. At that point, then the rule is filed with the Secretary of State in accordance with the statutes and their rule requirements. And at that point, the rule becomes effective unless there's a later effective date in the rule itself. The agency must also file a copy of the rule with legislative council within 10 days of adopting the rule. If they do not do so, then the rule is not effective. Any questions or comments about that before I'm going to turn to temporary rules here in a second? But.
So I do have one. Whose responsibility is it to ensure that these processes are followed?
Senator Riley, initially it is ordinarily the agency's own responsibility. We don't have a formal role to play in that. Agencies will often consult with us in their rulemaking processes, but at least at this initial stage, it's the agency's responsibility to do that. Now, be talking in a couple of minutes about how rules are reviewed and what some of the options are there. Mm-hmm. But yes, we hope that the agencies are doing their job, but if not, then there are some processes for addressing that.
I can maybe just add one comment, yeah. Chair Riley, members of the committee. You know, some large agencies who promulgate just tons of rules have kind of rules units that follow that through, but in many agencies, you just have a particular person who's working with their rules coordinator and who internally in the agency is responsible.
I did want to turn to talk a bit about temporary rules again. Most of that applies, what we've talked about applies to permanent rules. A lot of it does not necessarily apply to temporary rules. The temporary rules, under certain circumstances where an agency can identify a compelling need to adopt something right away to address a problem that specific serious consequences would arise if a rule were is not adopted. An agency can adopt a rule immediately and provide, and again, that rule can be effective for up to 180 days. After that, the rule expires. The agency cannot renew the temporary rule. They can adopt it if they've adopted the temporary rule and then want to adopt it as a permanent rule. They can go through the permanent rulemaking process to turn it into a permanent rule, but they cannot readopt it as a temporary rule again after 180 days. Again, there are a lot of process requirements that nevertheless apply to that, that the agency has to identify the consequences, have to cite legal authority, and these are subject to challenge. An agency can adopt a temporary rule, and again, somebody can challenge the justification for the temporary rule for doing this all without notice and hearing, and if a court determines that there was not sufficient justification for it, then the rule is invalidated. We do, though, again, often recommend, if there is at all time to do it, to do at least some notice and comment opportunity, even on temporary rules. If there's any way to provide some notice, to solicit some input from the public on it, to do that before adopting the rule. But they
I can maybe give you a common example of when an agency is going to adopt a temporary rule is the legislature passes some legislation and wants a program to be in effect at a certain time, and it's going to be complicated. Like recently, the school safety hotline, for instance, have it up and running. So the agency goes ahead and adopts a temporary rule to get the program running, and then simultaneously is kind of working on getting an advisory committee together and adopting a permanent rule.
So that's temporary rules. Amy mentioned that agencies are required to have a rules coordinator. Somebody who basically is responsible for the ministerial actions with regard to rules and with maintaining copies of them, being able to provide information to the public about the rules, keeping the agency's mailing list up to date. That is a statutory requirement that somebody fill that role for every agency. Then talking about the review of rules, there are several mechanisms for reviewing rules. One of them is that legislative council has a role in reviewing rules. They have the authority on their own initiative or at request of a legislator or of persons affected by the rule or some other circumstances of reviewing rules to determine whether they are within the intent and scope of the enabling legislation or whether they raise other constitutional or legal issues. And the legislative council then can develop a determination on that. If they conclude that it is not within the legal authority of the agency, they can prepare a negative determination. That's provided to the Legislative Council Committee. It can be posted on the website. In itself, it does not invalidate the rule, but it can trigger the interest of certainly the legislature or of individuals who have an interest in the rule to potentially pursue a agency or judicial challenge. Agencies are also required to review their own rules within 5 years of their adoption to determine whether they're basically doing what they intended to do, whether they are there have been changes in the law that may have undermined or had other undermining effects on the rule, determine whether the fiscal impact assessment was accurate, and to determine whether there's still a need for the rule, and then the agency can take appropriate action. Now, again, there's nothing that the agency is compelled to do, having made these assessments. It's informational. Certainly, you hope that agencies will, if they determine that a rule has outlived its purpose or whatever, do away with the rule. But there's nothing in the law itself that requires the agencies to take those actions.
Is there a question on that?
Yes, Senator Thatcher.
Because that was a bill I worked on back in 2005. I'm very curious how that process takes place. Who is, I guess, agencies, who do they answer to in this regard to assess whether this review has taken place and the results?
Chair Riley, Senator Thatcher, currently I don't believe that there is anybody who has that responsibility. Again, it's the agency's own responsibility to do that and police it. And it's not clear what the impact of failure to do that would to perform that review would actually be in a challenge to the rule, a judicial challenge to the rule. It's sort of a freestanding requirement that is there, and again, we certainly encourage agencies to comply with it, and we certainly do our best to comply with it. But again, in terms of monitoring that and enforcing that, there's not currently a mechanism for that. Finally, the review of rules that can actually invalidate a rule have a problem is judicial review. And there are a couple of avenues for judicial review. The avenue within the rulemaking statutes is that any person can petition the Court of Appeals to review of a rule to determine whether it's unconstitutional, exceeds the agency's authority, or was adopted not in compliance with the APA requirements. And if any of those are the case, then the court can strike down the rule or any particular rule that violates that. Also, anybody who's being part of an enforcement action brought under a rule can challenge the rule in the context of that enforcement action, first at the contested case level and then through appeal. A person who's in that situation can't bring the kind of direct review that I just talked about. They have to pursue a challenge through the process. The challenge in the context of somebody against whom a rule is being enforced can take various forms. One, the highest level is that the rule is invalid for one of these reasons. Two, it's invalid as applied to this individual, or three, that just factually the rule does not apply to the circumstances of the particular case. Finally, I wanted to mention that an individual, any interested person, can petition an agency to adopt, amend, or repeal the rule. It's a petition process for that. The agency has to then consider that, determine the agency can deny that petition. If somebody petitions for rulemaking, the agency can say, no, we're going to deny the petition. We aren't going to pursue that. But they can, if they grant the petition, then they have to initiate the formal rulemaking process and go through kind of all the steps that we've talked about and consider whether, particularly if there are questions about the negative impact on business, is there a continuing need? How is the rule working? Are there other alternatives for doing it and things of that nature?
Senator Thatcher.
I'm imagining if I was an agency person and somebody petitioning me to go through this big old, hurdles and all that, I'd be not excited to grant that. Is there any idea, would you have any idea of how many successful petitions there are, how many petitions there are to begin with, and how many are successful?
Chair Riley, Senator Thatcher, frankly, no. I have to be honest. I think that the petitions themselves are fairly rare, and that the number of those that are accepted by the agencies. I think the problem is, you know, some of the petitions of this kind are intended to remediate some particular grievance that a person has, and so an agency might not be inclined to pursue those. But it's difficult to know, you know, whether there's any sort of statistical trend in those.
Well, then a follow-up, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair. What is the recourse for a person who really feels like they, you know, would like to have a review of a rule?
Senator Riley, Chair Thatcher, I don't know that there's a formal process within the rulemaking rules. I think that in theory, at least, I suppose somebody could pursue a declaratory judgment action, or it might be considered a order in other than a contested case, and so that would be reviewable by the circuit court. The denial of the petition.
So they basically would have to sue.
Right? Basically.
And may I add one thing, Chair Riley, Senator Thatcher, the petition process has some real standards. If what you're petitioning for is to amend or repeal an existing rule, the statute says that this agency must go through all of these factors. So when someone is really objecting to a rule, there is some standards and teeth to this, and just the review that the agency has to do. When someone is just petitioning to have a rule adopted, that's not the case.
So if I could follow up just a little bit, is there any, or do you know of any statistics about how many lawsuits are brought because of agency rules? Is there any way to find that information?
Senator Riley, I'm not sure. Because the challenges can take various forms, mm-hmm. I think that these sorts of direct challenges to rules are kind of unusual. Most of the challenges are going to come up through the contested case process, and I don't know if we have, or if any of the agencies have at this point an effective mechanism of tracking that. We can certainly explore that and see if any of our colleagues at DOJ might have some. Most of these will be going through the appellate division, mm-hmm. and so they might have a good feel on that. So we can certainly ask them about that and get that information.
That. Thank you.
Yes. I think that those were really kind of the points we wanted to make in overview. I don't know if you have any further questions. Certainly happy to try to answer them.
Yes, Senator Thatcher.
How does a policy fit into all this? Where do the rules and policies cross each other?
Senator Riley, Chair Riley, Senator Thatcher, there are a set of things that are kind of not not rules. Anything that comes within the definition of a rule under the APA, which we advise agencies, those have to be adopted as rules, even if they're calling them a policy or a procedure or something, that has to be done. The a few things that are not just by statute that are not considered rules. Internal agency directives, regulations, or statements that don't substantially affect the interests of the public. That's one of the core things. If it affects the public, then it's going to be a rule. Anything that is between or among agencies, one agency is dealing with another, or employees or officers of the agency, or other units of governments, the governor's executive orders are not rules. Some things like that, and some Department of Corrections regulations are not administrative rules for purposes of the APA. So that deal with the internal operations and running of the prisons. But generally speaking, something that impacts the public at large, should be considered a rule and adopted in accordance with the APA procedures. The failure to do that means a couple of things. One principle is that rules are not only binding on the public, but they're binding on the agency themselves. The agencies have to conform to the requirements of their own rules. So if they've adopted a policy or procedure and are trying to enforce that, there are a couple of ramifications. One is that it's not necessarily enforceable against the person that they're trying to enforce it against. But if it is and should be considered a rule, it can be enforceable against the agency. It can bind the agency in its conduct. So it can be used by a member of the public as a sword against the agency, even if they are shielded by the fact that it hasn't been officially adopted as a rule.
That's interesting.
Any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciated the opportunity.
So now we're going to hear from the LC, Bielisa Cedric.
Good afternoon, Chair Riley, Vice Chair DeBoer. Now I know how to pronounce your name since you said it in the hearing here, and members of the committee. I'm Belissa Seidlick. I'm Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel, and I've been asked to provide a brief overview of our office's role with respect to administrative rule review. And our role actually comes in pretty late. It comes, as Mr. Wolf was saying, after the rule, whether it be a new rule, an amendment to a rule, or a repealed rule, it comes after the agency has adopted that rule or change. And our process is set forth in statute, so we have parameters. And the very first one that we encounter is that within 10 days, as Mr. Wolf was saying, within 10 days of the filing of the certificate of filing with the Secretary of State by the agency has to submit to us copies of the rule changes. And these changes must be delineated by bold or italics or highlighting, underlining, something that helps us see what they've done to make the rule either different or to make the rule new. So we will obtain those copies, and once we make files for them, we assign them for review to the attorney that has subject matter drafting responsibility for the agency involved. And the first thing that attorney does is look at that 10-day rule and see if it was complied with. And if it wasn't, even though we're not required to by statute, our office will provide a letter to the rule coordinator advising that we did not receive this copy within the 10 days, and pursuant to statute, the rule is not valid. I think Mr. Wolf referred to that. So that's an automatic invalidation of the rule to not submit copies to our office within 10 days. Most rules are submitted in that way. And also just a side note, it hasn't happened yet, but we are looking with the Secretary of State on how to do electronic submission of rules, so that once they're submitted to the Secretary of State, they're automatically sent to our office. And then that whole 10-day rule problem will probably disappear. The second thing that the attorney to whom the rule has been assigned does is, as Mr. Wolf referred to, look at the two things our office is charged with looking at. And the first one is the rule or rule change within the intent and scope of the enabling legislation. And the second thing is, does the rule or rule change raise constitutional issues? Those are the only two things that our office will look at. And by and far, probably about 98% of rules pass muster. And what happens then is they're indicated in our office's docket as being approved. And on a regular basis, maybe quarterly or biannually, our office will send to the rule coordinators an email indicating that if you haven't heard from us about rules X through Y, you can assume that the rule has been approved. For those rules that aren't approved by the assigned drafter, there are two things that may happen. First, the attorney may try an informal resolution, and that would involve calling up the rule coordinator and asking to speak to whomever drafted the rule to see if the issue can't be resolved. And most rule difficulties are resolved in this way. If for some reason the informal process is not going to work or is not appropriate, the attorney will prepare a negative determination letter indicating what the issues are, which rules are involved, and asking for a response in 30 days. Now, if, and once again, that's another chance to resolve the difficulties with the rules. If they still can't be resolved, then our office will send a copy of the negative determination letter to the interim committee to whom that agency has been assigned. And that's another one of our office's statutory duties. We have to create a subject matter list that assigns to each interim committee a list of agencies similar to the subject matter over which they have jurisdiction, and they are responsible for, with respect to rules that have negative determinations, they're responsible for holding a hearing, and it has to be during the interim. It can't be during session. It is only during the interim that it is held. And at this hearing, representatives from the agency or their attorney, their counsel, and a representative from our office will appear and present the various arguments or oppositions or agreements, whatever. And the interim committee is responsible for considering and deciding whether they will adopt Legislative Council's negative determination. There have been I've been here at Legislative Council since this process, which is relatively new, since 2009, and I would say there has been less than a dozen such hearings. And so at the hearing, once the usually the interim committee will decide whether or not they agree with Legislative Council's negative determination. And if they do, then the determination is posted on Legislative Council's website, where it will remain until either the rule is changed, a court says the rule is all right as it stands, the constitutional issues, if there are any, are resolved, or a court order says the rule is all right as it stands. Oh, excuse me, I already said that. I think the other one is if the agency or the legislature adopts new legislation that fixes the problem. Yes. So we have seen these negative determination letters that have been posted on the website come and go, not many of them, as I say, less than a dozen probably. At the current time, there is only one on, and it was actually one that I appeared on before the interim committee way back in 2010. And it still remains on there and probably will. But it is the only one currently that is on the website. Now, as Mr. Wolf pointed out, and this is important in the handout that I provided, you'll see at the bottom there is a box, a text box. This sets forth the doctrine of separation of powers and what the effect of a negative determination finding on a rule is. And basically, because of the doctrine of separation of powers, neither the legislature or legislative council can tell an agency that their rule cannot be implemented or that it has to be revoked. That is an executive function within their domain. And the practical effect of having a negative determination on the website is that it is posted publicly so that the public is aware that there is a problem that at least the legislature believes there's an issue with. And if someone cares to contest, as Mr. Wolf was talking about, contest the validity of the rule in court or otherwise, they have this negative determination letter.
So you say that the legislature can't invalidate the rule, but the legislature could pass legislation clarifying what they really meant?
Chair Riley, members of the committee, you're absolutely right. And that might be what will happen, and I've seen that happen before.
So one more. How many of these rules do you get in, say, a biennium to look at?
Well, let's see. Chair Riley, members of the committee, I have been here since this legislation was implemented, and we are up to 8,000. So that was 2009, and it's now so probably 2,000 a year or so.
And
how or much, not a year, a biennium.
Yeah. And how much staff time do you think this takes you?
Chair Riley, members of the committee, it takes a lot of staff time, and that is one of the difficulties is that during session, when we are busy drafting bills mm-hmm. and tending to the legislature's business, this gets, I would say, neglected in comparison to what we can do during the interim.
Mm-hmm. Well, that explains why you can't do this during the session. Mm-hmm. So, okay. All right.
And so basically that is the gist of what our office does, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Thatcher.
You said it would be the rule that is potentially a negative determination would be posted on your website. Are you part of OLIS, or is this a different website?
Chair Riley, Senator Thatcher, yes. Well, you know, actually, it's on the website, the legislature's website. I'm not sure it's on OLIS, and Cheyenne
Chair
is indicating
it's on the legislative website, but not separately listed on OLIS, as far as I know.
Right.
I'm wondering how a member of the public could find notice of a negative determination, because I'm just trying to do it myself right now.
Right. Well, Chair Riley, Senator Thatcher, you would go to the legislative website, click on Legislative Council, click on Administrative Rules, and then scroll down, and you will see that at the very bottom is the negative determination.
There it is. Shazam, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I think that comes to the end of our agenda. Anything for the good of the order from members? If not, I'm going to adjourn. Members? If not, I'm going to adjourn.